Welcome to Conscious Voices, a weekly program dedicated to bringing alternative points of view into challenging popular assumptions in order to help you be better informed and civically engaged. Well, it is with some sadness that we announce this week the death of radio collaborator, thinker, speaker, essayist, and activist Glenn Ford. If you're a longtime listener to the station, you may recall when Sonali Kolhatkar's show, Uprising, later Rising Up with Sonali, featured Glenn Ford's weekly Black Agenda Report segment. Ford was a Black Panther way back when, and an ally in a sense of the Communist Party, though not a member or an advocate per se. His pithy critiques from a radical Black perspective always involved a class consciousness that connected the struggle for Black liberation to the global struggle against imperialism, as well as including an anti-capitalist perspective. However, unlike the Communist Party or mainstream progressives, Glenn Ford was not reserved about calling out the deficiencies of Black leaders and figureheads who he felt betrayed the interests of Black liberation and democracy. Like Cornel West, Ford was an outspoken critic of Barack Obama. He was not especially gentle with the Black congressional Democrats who veered from the path of righteousness in his view, and he even took John Lewis to task on a number of issues. But whether one agreed with Glenn Ford or not, his arguments were always coherent and incisive, and his voice was clear and commanding. Like Mumia Abu-Jamal, the very sound of his baritone voice gave one pause to listen in the knowledge that something important was being said. And even for folks in the know who thought we had it all figured out, Glenn Ford would always leave our minds animated and processing. Glenn stopped into the WCRS studios a long, long time ago and gave a brief interview. Those recordings, if they're archived somewhere, are difficult to retrieve after the studio moved and computers were replaced, etc. Fortunately, everything else Glenn Ford recorded is still available in many places, including Pacifica and YouTube, and the website of the organization Glenn Ford founded with fellow former Panther David Dixon, called the Black Agenda Report. I don't know what Glenn Ford died from, but I was aware that he was a lifelong heavy smoker. He was just 71. In this show, we'll hear an address that Glenn Ford gave just last year on the occasion of the 14th anniversary of the Black Agenda Report.
It's so nice that so many of you who've been so kind to us will give up your time to help us on this occasion. We're honored that you came here to the People's Forum, which is staffed by some of the most committed revolutionaries in New York City, if not the planet. You've come here to hear about Black Agenda Report, but more specifically, as a tribute to Bruce Dixon, our co-founder, who passed away this summer. Bruce Dixon and I shared a history in the Black Panther Party, but he was in Chicago with Fred Hampton, and I was in New Jersey, and I didn't know him back then. We met, and by we I mean the co-founders, Bruce, Margaret, Kimberly, and I, in the process of building Barr's Forerunner. There was another magazine, a weekly, on the internet before Black Agenda Report. That journal was called The Black Commentator. The Black Commentator was created in April of 2002. Most of what I'm going to talk about this evening will focus on our time, the three co-founders, our time at The Black Commentator, because that is where what became Barr found its voice. In other words, the team spent 4 years finding out how to produce a weekly journal of news and commentary and analysis for the Black left before we actually came forward with Black Agenda Report. At the turn of the 21st century, in 2002, there wasn't any regular journal of the Black left. No such thing on the internet, no such thing in print, no such thing anywhere in the United States. In fact, the whole field was a desert in terms of Black political discourse on a regular published basis. There had been Freedom Ways magazine, which lasted for a very long time, but by 2002 it was long gone. And then for a very brief period, there was a magazine and commercial publication called Emerge, and it became rather famous when it published a magazine cover depicting Clarence Thomas as a lawn jockey. And that was great fun, and we wanted to follow in those footsteps. But Emerge quickly faded from the scene as well. And none of that should have been surprising, that there wasn't any longevity in left-ish, black-ish publications, because for two generations already at the turn of the 21st century, there had been no Black mass movement. Periodicals of analysis and debate are components, absolutely necessary components of mass political struggle. And although political journals can't jumpstart mass movements on their own, they can tie the residue of previous mass movements, like our own of the 60s and the 70s, tie those residue, the people who are still there and still struggling, together with a new crop of people that have never experienced a mass movement. So even when there is no mass movement, there is a need for a publication like what Barr became in the interregnum between mass struggles. We had a rather vague mission when we began, and I'm talking about a gentleman by the name of Peter Gamble and myself, when we co-founded the Black Commentator. As the publication date approached, we had prepared a number of articles. We had cartoons on order, but we didn't have any cover story. We had nothing that would identify or do an analysis of the paramount issue of the day. Frankly, I didn't know what the paramount issue of the day was. There were lots of issues, but how are we going to make this debut with this analysis on the paramount issue of the day? But the fact was that the issue was right in front of my face, and I didn't even know it. Cory Booker. And I'd known Cory Booker for about 2 years by that time. I had no idea he was paramount anything. But Cory Booker was the key to this whole question about the paramount issue. I'd become familiar with Cory Booker while working with a small newspaper that I helped found in northern New Jersey. Cory was only about 30 years old at that time. He was just completing his first term on the Newark City Council. But he had already made a national debut with a power lunch at the Manhattan Institute. And if you know anything about how these things work, a power lunch at the Manhattan Institute tells the whole constellation of right-wing corporate forces that this guy is one of ours. Support him. Now, I didn't know that at the time. But Cory made that debut, in fact, about a year before the Black Commentator was launched. When Cory announced that he was going to run for mayor, the mayor didn't take it very seriously because he was only a 30-year-old first-time Newark City Councilman. How could he touch him? I did know that Cory wasn't quite that simple. And when he made his announcement, his formal announcement that he was running for mayor, I went to it. And immediately after that announcement had been made, I went to the internet because I wanted to see how the web would respond to his announcement. And I was astounded. It really shocked me. I'm shocked today, shocked partly at why I was shocked. Because I had no idea what was out there supporting this Corey person. The whole right-wing universe on the web lit up after he made his announcement. And they were all cheering Booker, and they were calling him by his first name, Corey, Corey, Corey. And when I saw that, I knew that everything had changed in terms of the black political arena. Something big was happening that even people who thought of themselves as politically astute, like myself, did not realize was underway. I immediately did some furious research, and I discovered a lot more about Cory Booker and his right-wing connections. It was widely known, everybody knew, that Cory Booker ran two private schools in Newark and that he was a proponent of private school vouchers. Under George Bush, private school vouchers and the faith-based initiative, which was aimed at bribing black preachers, had become the basis of the Republican Party's appeal to blacks. In fact, that was their only appeal, school vouchers and bribe your preacher. Both of those initiatives were sponsored by the Bradley Foundation out of Milwaukee, Wisconsin, and that was President Bush's favorite foundation. He said so, and they gave him his whole plank for black people. In the 90s, the Bradley Foundation organized a spectrum, a broad spectrum, of its fellow right-wing funders to create a black AstroTurf organization that would be given the mission of pushing the right-wing agenda in blackface, with a special focus on the privatization of public schools. It was called the Black Alliance for Educational Options. It was funded by millions of dollars from all of the right-wing money bags. And only a year or two later, when he was elected president, George Bush funded it also to the tune of millions of dollars. So it became a federal project. Cory Booker was the alliance's co-chair. He was already the co-chair of this mega-funded AstroTurf corporate right-wing organization when he made his announcement that he was going to run for mayor. So Cory Booker was not just a first-term Newark City Councilman of only 30 years of age. He was the point person for what was to become the right's biggest political offensive in black America, I believe, ever. Another person on the that AstroTurf organization was Congressman Floyd Flake from Queens. Congressman Flake was the only actual genuine right-winger conservative on the Congressional Black Caucus. The caucus didn't have any of those people on it in 2002, except Floyd Flake, who had retired by that time. Floyd Flake went on to make millions in a school privatization company, all of whose business was engendered by the Bush administration's attack on public schools. He was a member of the Manhattan Institute's board. So you see this connection, this network that was being put together with most of us not paying any attention. There were also lots of other nominal black Democrats in the Alliance for Educational Options. And what this signaled was the start of a new political chapter, because the corporations had given up on black Republicanism. There had been no black person elected to Congress as a Republican since the last one was turned out of office. His name was Oscar DePriest in Chicago in 1935. Since that time, no black person has been elected to Congress as a Republican in a black district. There have been black congressmen, black Republican congressmen, but they came from white districts. So black folks weren't going that way. And by the turn of the century, that was finally got the heads of the Republican, at least the money bags of the Republican Party. So they decided that they were going to break in to this Democratic field, which they had not tampered with before, not with black ghetto politics. That was off limits. In most districts back then, a black congressperson could easily coast to re-election for less than $100,000, or often far less, $50,000. These were very safe seats back then because they weren't being primaried, and they faced no Republican opposition. Most of the money that went to black Democrats in Congress came from labor unions, and they could expect that year after year after year. Black congresspeople were therefore almost never primaried. In that sense, the racist and rich right-wingers worked in black Democratic politicians' favor by leaving them alone. And in fact, blacks in Congress had significantly more seniority as a group than white people in Congress. Their seats were safer. So they weren't prepared at all for this political situation to change. But it did change. All of it changed at the dawn of the 21st century. Corporate money allowed Cory Booker to run for mayor of the quintessentially chocolate city, Newark. And it allowed him to vastly overspend the money that was held by the incumbent. And the incumbent was supposed to be the most powerful black politician in New Jersey. Booker wasn't the only one. Little known challengers from out of nowhere came with huge campaign war chests to challenge Congressman Earl Hilliard in the Black Belt of Alabama and Cynthia McKinney in suburban Atlanta, Georgia, in this same period in 2002. Understanding that public education has utterly failed black America, the corporate think tankers found a strategy that would work for them. They reasoned that they could drive a wedge between the teachers' union and blacks. And without the teachers' union and blacks, there is no Democratic Party. And the way to do that would be to focus on the schools. And they focused first with private vouchers, and then only a couple of years later, they switched to charter schools, and that was far more successful. Our first cover story, this is the Black Commentator in search of a cover story, that was it. By the time I finished checking out what Cory Booker was doing and who was backing him, we knew that we had the paramount issue of the time. It was titled Fruit of the Poison Tree. It explained Cory's candidacy as the tip of the spear of an historic right-wing offensive in black America. Just 2 weeks after that first issue appeared, our analysis was featured on the front page of the New York Times, and we got to piss all over Cory Booker's parade. And that was personally very satisfying, because you need that kind of encouragement when you're stepping into a void, a twilight zone that people have not explored. We got that thanks to the New York Times. It is always like that. We badmouth these mother, but when they give us some play, we consider that a big victory. And it felt like one, and it felt like something quite different to Cory Booker. The black Democrats, however, they didn't know what hit them when this Cory Booker campaign hit the streets. It took them all by surprise, not just the mayor, all of them. Sharp James, that's the mayor's name, tried to figure out what we, the black commentator, was saying in print. He read Fruit of the Poison Tree over and over. He told me so. And he said that he had it figured out and he understood it. This guy will just hook up with anybody to get elected. And that's why there's all these strange white men in suits all over Newark. And I said, it's something like that. It wasn't quite like that. What Sharp James got from our analysis of these corporate forces coming together for an historic political offensive in black America, what he got was that Cory Booker has hooked up with the Ku Klux Klan. And so he held press conferences saying that all over Newark and making himself look ridiculous. Meanwhile, Cory Booker kept on climbing in the polls. He was spending three times as much money as the mayor. And the mayor could not understand it because he couldn't understand what we were saying about Cory Booker serving corporate interests, because Mayor Sharp James, like every other black mayor, was very close to, very obedient to, in fact, the local corporate barons. He thought he was getting along just fine with them and doing everything they say. So why would corporate America be against me? He couldn't figure it out. And he stayed confused like that. But it wasn't working, and Cory Booker kept on climbing in the polls, and they started getting desperate. And so in the last 2 weeks of the campaign, all of the literature that was being handed out by Sharp James's reelection people and the host of unions that were also in the street trying to stop Cory Booker, they were in fact handing out Xeroxed copies of articles in the Black Commentator. And if you went to the mayor's campaign website, before you even saw a picture of the mayor or a quote of anything that he said, you saw an article from the Black Commentator. Because they just decided that these guys know how to explain it. I don't know. I don't understand it. So anyway, we wound up, narrowly defeating Cory Booker his first time around by about 3%. And, you know, I don't even know if that was a good thing or not. It was good for Newark. It held him off for 4 years. But it also had the effect of stopping him from becoming the first Obama. So he would have been in a position to at least believe that that was his next goal. And he had the backing of all these powerful corporate forces. So I'm sure that Cory Booker thought that that was going to be his trajectory. But instead, we got the Obama that we came to know and loathe, who is far smarter, far more charming, far more effective, which is why I called him the more effective evil than Cory Booker ever could have been. So in the long run, I don't know if we did the nation and the world as a whole any great favor by defeating Cory Booker in 2002 and burst or temporarily holding up his dream, because that might have ensured Barack Obama in 2008. Anyway, so we beat Cory Booker, but he wasn't the only one. They had two other offensives, two other races that they had initiated to see if this new strategy works. One was against Earl Hilliard, as I said, in the Black Belt of Alabama, a relatively progressive lawmaker and especially outspoken on foreign policy. And the other was Cynthia McKinney, whom all of you, I'm sure, know and love. In Atlanta, Georgia, these were national campaigns, because these right-wing corporations, since they own the media, are very good with handling the media. And although the Hilliard race and the McKinney race were just one of 435 congressional races that occur every 2 years, they were national news. And they were very important news pieces, too. The main corporate media assigned their black reporters to the story so that their positions on McKinney and Hilliard would have more legitimacy. At root, what they were trying to say is that black Americans get more conservative as they move incrementally up the income ladder, that as more black people became middle class, whatever that is, they would become more conservative. I don't know how they measure conservatism, but anyway, that was their logic. No one had ever produced any empirical evidence that that's the way that it goes. And I think that underlying this theory, which is really a position, was a desire to negate black politics, to say that black people have no worldview, that it means to be black is to have suffered Jim Crow and deprivation and poverty. Like, blackness is just a bunch of have-nots, but not incapable of developing a worldview, much less an anti-corporate rule or anti-imperialist worldview. So they'll grow out of that if they just get into the middle class. And then they attach that wish, they attach to that wish a theory about black middle class folks are more conservative. And then they elaborate upon it and say that the civil rights type strident and militant talking black politician is passé. That's of another age, and black folks are rejecting that. And so to prove this position, which is not even worthy of being called a theory, they focused on these two races, in which challengers, unknown people, basically, in both of those districts, had been given 2 and 3 times as much campaign money as Hilliard and McKinney. But this was the showdown that would prove the theory promulgated by the corporate media. We at the Black Commentator spent much of our time debunking that theory. The corporations don't feel that they have to prove these statements, these broad statements that they make, because they don't have to read studies, because these rich men control the media and they can prevail simply by repetition. And so Cynthia McKinney, faced with overwhelming money, lost her bid for re-election, as did Earl Hilliard. And when that happened, we published an article that was titled, how did it go? Cynthia McKinney's Honorable Defeat. And then I got an email from somebody from Chicago who explained that he had been involved for decades in political campaigns. And he said, yeah, you know, honorable defeat. I know she was defeated. I don't know how honorable it was. And then he proceeded to explain from his viewpoint why Cynthia McKinney was defeated. Bruce Dixon was that person. He's the one who was emailing me from Atlanta. And he explained that McKinney had won just as many votes in the 2002 losing election as she had won in her previous winning elections. So it wasn't about her losing support. It was about her not being able to mobilize additional voters to stem the tide that had been mobilized by all that money that had been thrown at their at her opponents. I immediately arranged to call Bruce Dixon up on the phone because I thought it was our job at the Black Commentator to show with real figures that Cynthia McKinney had, in fact, won overwhelmingly the Black election. Remember, we're not talking about who wins or loses finally at the polls, but countering that proposition that Black folks were turning against a so-called civil rights type strident and militant politicians, obviously like Earl Hilliard and Cynthia McKinney. So the question was, is that true? Did Cynthia McKinney lose the Black election? That was the point. So Bruce and I got on the telephone, and we had a long conversation about how we can do this, and that was the beginning of a conversation that lasted 17 years until this June. I'm telling this story as a way to say how we met Bruce Dixon, because everything about how all of us at Black Agenda Report met is about politics. It's about struggle. It's about how we came together to fix something or figure out something in struggle. So that's the way the story needs to be told. Bruce, as I said, was the veteran of countless down-and-dirty Chicago election campaign. So he knew every which way to do dirt or how to defend oneself against dirt. We spoke almost every night trying to figure out how we counter this corporate offensive. And during one of these late-night sessions, Bruce and I analyzed the tally, the actual voter tally from that election. It showed that McKinney had garnered the same 45,000 votes during that election as she did in the previous two elections. And it showed that McKinney decisively won every Black precinct, including places like Stone Mountain, Georgia. Now, Stone Mountain, Georgia, these days, is majority white. Majority Black. And that Black population in Stone Mountain, Georgia, is, relatively speaking, quite upscale. So when you talk about upscale Black folks in that part of metropolitan Atlanta, you're probably talking Stone Mountain, Georgia. DeKalb County, which is the heart of Cynthia McKinney's district, is the second most affluent Black majority county in the country, second only to Prince George's County right outside Washington, D.C. So if we're talking about a model for how affluent Blacks vote, then DeKalb County is the perfect place. If McKinney overwhelmingly won the Black vote in DeKalb County against a conservative but Black and Democratic challenger who outspent her 2 or 3 to 1, then the theory that Blacks go rightward when they become middle class is busted. It's worthless, and it's been proven on the ground. And it also invalidates the position, and it's the twin position, that a Black political consensus on social and economic justice and peace does not exist. You see, with this theory that Black people simply vote based upon how much money they got in their pocket, you negate Black people have any politics at all. That is the worldview that I was talking about. At the Black Commentator, we felt it was our job to prove and prove again what was obvious to us, but needed to be proved and proved again because it was under attack, that there was a black consensus on social and economic justice and peace. And that is what had governed our politics all of these years. And we were not just a bag of have-nots that could be manipulated simply by throwing us some coins. Bruce and I finally calculated, and this is by giving Denise Majette, the challenger, every benefit of the doubt, that Cynthia won at least 70% of the vote. But about 2 months after we published our article, a white political scientist at the University of Georgia that the Atlanta Journal-Constitution considered to be their guru and expert on all things political did his own study, and he found that Denise Majette, the challenger, only got 15% of the black vote. And in his column, he recommended that she get out of politics or run someplace white. So we were right about this. But these are the kinds of struggles that you have to tackle if you are going to counter this corporate narrative that lies at the drop of a hat, that lies before it investigates. And if it investigates and finds that what it was about to say was a lie, it figures out how to lie more skillfully. And there must be mechanisms to challenge those lies, because even our cadres in the streets are bombarded by the same lies and are sometimes believe them and carry on, but still believe them. While Bruce and I were wrestling with the McKinney election statistics, we got a letter from the editor. Someone sent an email to us, and it said, letter to the editor, from a young woman in New York City. She'd written for us a brilliant letter that was critiquing Condoleezza Rice. Do you remember her? George Bush's national security advisor. The letter had a title to it. Its title was Condoleezza Rice and the Birmingham Bombing Victims. And the writer's name was Margaret Kimberly. And so I wrote her back. I was really very impressed. It was beautiful writing. And I asked Margaret if she might consider doing a column for us. And she said yes. I'll do one every week. Now, when she said every week, that scared me. Because we had been in operation about a year. And we had asked other people who wrote very good letters if they might do a column. And all of them seemed anxious to be regulars. But what we found is that even the most eloquent of these writers usually had only one note to sing. And after they sang that note, they didn't have any more. And when they couldn't come up with a new idea, a new approach, a new column on schedule, then they got mad at you. And so then burnout is ugly. So I was afraid, for Margaret to volunteer to produce more than she might be able to handle. But she assured me, no, I could do every week. I say, okay. See, what I did not know is that not only did Margaret have more than one note to sing, she could sing more than a whole chorus, more than a whole opera. She had more notes than an orchestra, and she's been playing those notes for 17 years now. Now back to me and Bruce trying to deal with these Democrats, because that was the problem. We were trying to figure out what was the best way to explain, to analyze, and then set some other forces in motion to stem what was clearly not a drift to the right among black Democrats, but a rush to the right. Now, we knew that they were scared of money. That was quite clear when the attacks on Cynthia and on Earl Hilliard had the desired effect. All of a sudden, all of these caucus members who had been in these safe seats realized that they could be primaried. They wouldn't even know where the money came from, but when it landed, they were in trouble. So they all immediately started adjusting their positions. And we went from a black caucus that had only one conservative right-wing member. At one time, that was Floyd Flake. Then he was quickly succeeded by that boy from Memphis. What's his name? Harold Ford, yes, succeeded. But Harold Ford was by himself because Flake had already lost. However, by 2005, remember, the offensive against McKinney and Hilliard was 2002. By 2005, there was a clear faction, a right-wing faction in the caucus. That is five or six of them that were consistently voting corporate. And there were more than that who were consistently voting for the war industries. All right, so it occurred that quickly. That's how powerful that scare was. But as we were wrestling with these questions, one of the things that I did every day or once a week was go on what I call DLC patrol, Democratic Leadership Council patrol. The Democratic Leadership Council was the corporate wing of the Democratic Party founded by Bill Clinton and Al Gore in the 80s. Its purpose was to weaken the rising representation of blacks and labor in the Democratic Party. It was a very right-wing offensive. But in 2002 and 2003, the DLC was on a really big recruitment drive for black politicians to try to shed its anti-black, well-deserved anti-black reputation. So every week I go on the New Democrat site and see which black politician they had suborned, who had jumped onto that ship. And so in January, February, March, April, May, in May of 2003, this guy named Barack Obama's name was on the list. And I remembered that Bruce said something about somebody named Barack Obama. So I said, let me call Bruce and see what this is about. So I called Bruce up, and before I can explain why I'm calling him, he's blurting out to me. He says, Barack Obama has taken his anti-war speech off of his website. I said, damn. Barack Obama at that time was running in the Democratic primary for the U.S. Senate. He had the previous October made what became his famous anti-war speech. It wasn't that anti-war, but it was not pro-war. His October 2003 speech, and he had put that on as an important part of his campaign website. He was looking to get the anti-war vote, and he needed to get every black vote of every political stripe in order to stand any chance in this primary election. Finally, I got Bruce to explain to me who this Obama guy was, and he did. And I asked him, well, what are we going to do about this guy? I read that people are talking about him, that he's a rising star. I see he's a handsome person. He looks like the kind of package that they like in retail politics. He said, well, why don't we just talk to him? I said, yeah, let's talk to him. How do we do that? He said, well, I got his number. It turned out that Bruce Dixon had worked under Barack Obama when Obama was head of a massive voter registration drive in 1992 in Chicago that registered a couple of 100,000 new voters, and that registration drive is credited with electing Carolyn Moseley Brown, the first black woman senator. And Bruce was one of his lieutenants. And so Bruce went to Barack and Michelle's wedding and had his home number right there in his pocket. So Bruce called him up and said, you know, we need to talk to you about your membership in the DLC. Obama denied that he was in the DLC. We knew that was a lie because we got it from the DLC newsletter. And we understood that when you're featured in that newsletter, that really has the same purpose as the Manhattan Institute inviting you to be the star of their power luncheon. It tells everybody, this is our guy, he's all right, give him some money. He's been vetted. DLC was a vetting instrument, and Obama had submitted to that vetting. So we argued with him on the phone. It was like a three-way, and got tired of that. And he said that he and we had already written an article questioning whether he was in the DLC by this time. And so Obama said, "Well, let me write something." And so he answered Bruce Dixon's article questioning Obama about his apparent membership in the DLC, denying that he was a member. You can see that article. It really is of historical importance. If you go to the Black Commentator, look at the whole month of June, and you will see the back and forth between Obama and us. We got tired after he did his reply. We still couldn't get a truthful answer out of him. And so finally I said, you know, I'm tired of this. Let's give him a bright line test. And there'll be three questions. And if he answers all three of them correctly to our satisfaction, then he should not be in the DLC, even if he is. And if he answers them incorrectly, then he ought to be in the DLC. And so we sent him the three questions. And, you know, I forgot one of those questions, but two of them were, if I am elected to the United States Senate, I will immediately submit a bill to withdraw from Iraq. And the same language to establish single-payer health care. And there was another issue, too, that he would lie about. He sent us a reply, and you can see that in one of these June 2003 issues, in which he fudged every single answer. And anybody would have flunked him as having not satisfactorily responded to the question. And that put Bruce and me in a quandary, because we knew that this guy was up and coming, and he was such an attractive package. And although Bruce had known him earlier, I had gotten to talk to him, and I said, this guy's charming, too. He was scarily charming, you know. And what we were afraid of, since the Black Commentator was only a year old, and we were trying to figure how we walk this thing, we were afraid that we would be criticized as crabs in a barrel. That's always trying, every time a brother moves up, then crabs in a barrel trying to drag him back down. And so, frankly, we punked out. We should have flunked him, but we passed him and let it go and hoped that maybe he'd get run over by a car or something. But that we weren't going to hurt ourselves by criticizing him. Anyway, about that, as the next two years and 3 years wore on, we decided, and I'm not going to elaborate on it, and I never have, that the Black Commentator wasn't the vehicle for us. So Margaret and Bruce and I decided that we would launch another magazine, but we didn't have any money. So I went to Bill Lucy of the Coalition of Black Trade Unionists, who'd been a comrade of mine for since the 70s, and told him our problem. And Bill Lucy gave us $10,000, which was in the form of a purchase of advertising, which they of course didn't need, but that's how we did the transaction, and that was enough for us to, some months later, in October of 2007, launch Black Agenda Report. But we didn't know how to build a website. So in that interim, Bruce Dixon learned the rudiments of site building so that when the time came, we were ready. The site was kind of rickety, but it was good to look at, and it got us started. We published that first issue, as I said, in October of 2006. It seemed that we had only just gotten started, however, when the Black political environment absolutely collapsed. It collapsed in an Obama maniacal delirium. And when I say collapsed, I mean that the revolutionaries that we thought we knew, our comrades that we had been in so many struggles and movement activities with over decades and decades, people who said that they were they were revolutionaries to the death, we found with Barack Obama's rise and subsequent nomination that all these brothers and sisters really wanted was a Black president. That was it. And they never imagined that they might get one, and so they talked this revolutionary stuff. But the brass ring seduced them immediately. And that began what we called the lonely time. And in that period, our mission, although it remained the same, to confront the rule of the rich, the rule of the racist rich, the rule of capital. Although our mission remained the same, we often felt that all we were accomplishing, these were on bad days, that all that we were accomplishing is letting scattered folks who had not lost their minds behind Obama know that they were not crazy, that they were sane. You know, this was the weekly reminder of their sanity. During this Black Agenda Report period, we, of course, met the people who filled out the voice that we had tried to develop at the Black Commentator. It gave us range and gave us depth and made us funnier and more likable people than we were. And that, of course, includes Tony Montero, Dr. Tony Montero from Philadelphia, who does not contribute many articles to us, but they're all so heavy that it takes us weeks to digest them. So I think he's being merciful to us by only dribbing and drabbing us articles. And of course, we met Raymond Nat Turner and Nellie Bailey. Nellie Bailey, who introduced me to many of you, and I'm eternally grateful for being a guide to left politics in New York City. We met Marsha Coleman Adebayo, who's there. She's the veteran activist, and she's a scientist, and she's a famed whistleblower. And Ajamu Baraka, who is a soulmate of all of us and also an editor and a columnist of Black Agenda Report, which he was before he ran for vice president on the Green Party's ticket. And then later, we were so fortunate in meeting Danny Haifong, our contributing editor. And Danny Haifong, in turn, met Roberto Servant. And Roberto Servant is now the book forum editor of Black Agenda Report. Now, I'm going to talk about that a little later on. But the team of Danny Haifong and Roberto Servent then created this magnificent book on American exceptionalism, which examines that subject back and forth, up and down in all of its aspects. I think it's one of the most important political works of the last several years, because it tackles something that is not so easily grasped. You can't put American exceptionalism in numbers. You can't run the metrics on it. It has to do with political culture. It has to do with the past invading the present. These are difficult subjects, and yet Danny and Roberto explored them relentlessly and effectively, and I'm so glad that we can get some of the glory out of that book. And Margaret's going to give us some more in January. And finally, and I think I've used up all my time, haven't I, Nellie? Yes, I have. Finally, I want to talk about the Barr Book Forum. And there's a little, very brief story on that. I had always wanted to establish a website, a publication, that would do for the black left intelligentsia, not that I knew too many of these people, but I imagine they were out there, which would do for the black left intelligentsia what publications like the old New York Review of Books or the London Review of Books did for leftish white intelligentsia, that they have this kind of forum for argumentation. But that was just a dream that I couldn't, was I'm not equipped to put in motion, because I'm not from academia and I don't know the world of books. And Bruce Dixon, although more educated than me, also didn't understand that world. And Margaret, who is superbly educated, she doesn't know about that world either. And so we were not equipped to put this in motion, and I was about to let the domain site die or relapse. And then Danny met Roberto. And Roberto said, I'll do that. And within months, he was doing that. And we have been blessed to have this ongoing, every week, focus on books by left and mostly black intellectuals, not all of them academics, many of them activists as well, so that we can provide a forum for their works so that people know about them, but more than that, a place for a conversation about the vital subjects that they raise. So I guess on our 13th birthday, we are almost grown. We're getting there. I think we're adolescent, but that means there is a promise of much better to come. Thank you so much.
Glenn Ford presente. I have a lot of Ford's audio essays on file, and I'll comb through them to pull out timely and timeless portions from later shows. My most recent correspondence with Ford was with regard to some people in my neighborhood who chose January 6th of this year to start flying one of those obnoxiously large Trump flags. That caused an uproar among some of my neighbors, and around that time, Glenn published an essay on how to respond to people who attempt to antagonize their neighbors with visual displays of pro-Trump bigotry like that. I shared that article with the neighbors, and many of them commented favorably, and Glenn Ford had a brief dialogue with us about that, which I found endearing. He'll be missed, but not forgotten. This has been Conscious Voices, heard each week at this time on your community radio stations, WCRSLP 92.7 and 98.3 FM, and WGRNLP 94.1 FM in Columbus, Ohio. I'm Evan Davis, and I'll be with you again next week for another edition. Take care. The program you are listening to is broadcast both on community radio station WCRS via translator W245AY at 98.3 FM and on WGRN 94.1 FM, WCRSFM.org and WGRN.org. If you like what you're hearing or want to get involved, please visit those websites and give what you can. Both stations are non-commercial and volunteer-run. Both stations depend on listener support. Again, the websites are wcrsfm.org for WCRS and wgrn.org for WGRN.
This is Professor Howard Zinn. The independent, non-commercial radio station you're listening to is really important in the maintenance of democracy. Thomas Jefferson once said, an informed democracy will behave in a reasonable manner. So if you care about being informed, if you care about democracy, if you're a reasonable person, you are, of course. Please support your source for uncensored news and views and the voice of your